Hi, I'm John.
And I'm Julie.
We're the hosts of the Hartford Fund's Human-Centric Investing Podcast.
Every other week, we're talking with inspiring thought leaders to hear their best ideas for how you can transform your relationships with your clients.
Let's go.
Sherry, welcome to the Human-Centric Investing Podcast. We're so excited to have you here with us today.
Well, it's great to be with you both. Thank you.
Sherry, I know I've been looking forward to this podcast for quite a while because I think it's something that our listeners can benefit from both personally and professionally. Many of us have found ourselves in the position of being a caregiver, or perhaps supporting a caregiver for a loved one who's been diagnosed with dementia. So we're trying to get some idea from you about really the best approach, or best practices, if you would, for people who are caregiving presently, maybe people who think it may be in their future, maybe for financial professionals seeking to prepare their clients for such a situation. So where do we start? How do we begin thinking about the best way to provide care for a loved one who may have been diagnosed with dementia?
Yeah, that's such a great question, John. And I think that, you know, first of all, just understanding that because we do have these bonus years of life, we're living longer. We know that some of the statistics around Alzheimer's and dementia. So, for instance, one out of every three seniors will have some type of dementia after the age of 85. And so just being prepared for that, I think, as a family, because very often I'll talk to people who say, well, we don't have that in our family. But that doesn't necessarily mean that you won't encounter it in your lifetime. And I think the biggest thing for the family caregivers is to really understand that this is a neurodegenerative progressive disease. So you are going to go through stages where the disease behaviors and the ability to communicate and all that is going to start to become very challenging. And so understanding what those three main stages of Alzheimer's are and what to expect, I think is really kind of the first step for a lot of families, just having that knowledge and understanding that this is kind of how they're going to have to navigate this journey.
Sherry, I'm really curious as to what those three steps are. My family is navigating this with my grandfather as we speak. He's in hospice and has been diagnosed with dementia. And I find that when I go to visit him, because the conversation is so repetitive, I'm having to prepare myself before I walk in the door. So I'm so excited to learn from you today. But what are those three stages, and how can we probably, I would imagine, prepare ourselves as we're entering those environments so that we can be as supportive to the individual as possible?
Right. So I think some of the things for the audience to know and understand is that a lot of times, particularly in the past, we were not diagnosing someone with Alzheimer's or dementia until later stage of the disease. And they may have been living with the disease for 10, 15, possibly even 20 years, where there were small, maybe little red flags that had gone overlooked or passed off as just normal aging. But we're getting better at diagnosing. We even have now blood tests that you can take. It used to be a PET scan that you would have to have that would show what was happening in the brain. But now we have blood tests that can show biomarkers of risk or escalating things that are happening. And if you get an early stage diagnosis, this is where you want to really have that communication with family, because you want your loved one to be able to express their wishes. This is what they want to have happen as the disease starts to take away their ability to communicate, to make decisions, those types of things, where they will live, how they want to live. Those are all really critical. This is also a time where, you know, our loved ones are going to want to stay at home, of course. That's what we all want as we age, to stay at home as long as possible. And so you're going to need to look to do some things maybe in the home to make it dementia friendly. And it's very specific, even different from what we call age friendly design in the home. And maybe also embrace some of the age tech or dementia tech solutions and wearables and gadgets and apps and other things that are out there that, again, can provide safety, can provide independence for the person with dementia while they're still living at home. Now, of course, as you get into the second and third stages of the disease, the progression continues. And this is where then we see we're going to need maybe more help, because we aren't all trained as dementia clinicians and healthcare professionals. So bringing those people into the home will become something that you'll have to, assess as a family. And certainly then we start to look at the costs of care. And in the end stage of the disease, what I've seen happen with many, many families is the desire is to keep their loved one at home, but it really becomes a 24/7 proposition. And because they forget to hydrate, they forget to eat, they can't communicate, everything is now being communicated mostly through the eyes. And there's just so much that you have to pay attention to or understand or know. You either have to bring in, as I mentioned, a 24/7 staff for that dementia care, or this is where we see caregivers going sleepless because they're going to pick up one of those 8-hour shifts or whatever it is. But that's where the cost can really escalate. And in fact, if you're keeping your loved one at home and you need that dementia care 24/7 support, it can be upwards of $360,000 a year to do that. And I think that's the sticker shock that a lot of families don't anticipate, that if you can start earlier in the journey, having those discussions and really plotting that out with a financial professional, you know, who can help you, it'll make that transition a lot easier.
So, Sherry, just to recap on those three stages, the first stage is where the person who's been diagnosed is able to stay at home. They can function with the disease. What marks that transition? I know they're not bright, clear lines, but what marks the transition to the second phase?
Yeah. So one of the things, there's a couple of things that we know. And of course, every person is an individual who goes through these stages at a different pace. And it can take, you know, whatever period of time. But one thing I think the audience should be aware of is that in traditional family caregiving, the average time we're spent caring for a loved one, maybe who has heart disease or cancer, is about 4.5 years. That's on average. The average dementia caregiver journey is twice as long. It's 9 years on average, but it can also be a 20-year journey. So this is definitely a marathon, not a sprint. And I think what, you know, distinguishes the stages is in that first stage, there might be a little bit of memory loss, some concerns around, will they get lost? You know, how independent can they be? That's where a lot of the technology helps out. In the second stage, one of the things that we know is that 60% of Alzheimer's adults will wander. So this is where it becomes really critical to have certain things in place, whether that's automatic door locks where you're at work, you're the family caregiver or the spouse. You can open the door if there's maybe a delivery that you know is coming from, you know, UPS or FedEx. But you can also lock the door to keep your loved one safe, keep them inside, or use a wearable with a GPS tracker that can become really helpful. We also know that when you have Alzheimer's, you have more balance issues than traditional seniors, where we know 1 in 4 seniors will fall in the home after the age of 65. But that number goes up when you have dementia because of what's happening in the brain. There is a lot of dysfunction going on and your balance becomes even worse. So making sure some of those home safety modifications are in place, understanding balance and clearing all that clutter out and some of the other things that we advise when we, you know, come into the home and do a care assessment for what the design should look like become really critical. And then the third thing in the second stage is there's something called sundowning. Many of your listeners may have heard of this, but what happens is at dusk, an Alzheimer's adult starts to become very paranoid. They may lash out, they may cry, they may scream. It's a very disturbing episode for a family caregiver who has no idea what this is. And we still don't know the reasons why, but we do know that when you have Alzheimer's, your circadian rhythms are thrown off. You're going to be much more active at night and up and, you know, maybe wandering out of the house. And during the day, you'll be sleepier. So one of the things that we're seeing is that if you can adjust the light shades in the home before that dusk happens so that they don't see the sun disappearing, which we think creates this fear in the brain. Or you can also use light therapy. I'm seeing some really great research pilots being done where if you use a light therapy lamp, like people do for seasonal affective disorder who live in places where it's overcast or raining a lot, if you do just 10 to 20 minutes in the morning of light therapy and maybe 10 to 20 minutes around lunchtime, that actually can help alleviate some of those sundowning episodes. And then just keeping your loved one active, because that will also then help with all of that. And then, as I mentioned, in the third stage, this is where it all becomes about the five senses. They're not able to really communicate. You know, aphasia takes place where they are mixing up words or sentences, or sometimes can't even be able to communicate. So things that are brushing their hair, putting lotion on their hands, playing music that goes back to their early, you know, years, because they have the longer term memory of remembering things between the ages of 10 and maybe 25. Not necessarily those short-term memories of knowing who their grandkids are or who they met, you know, just a couple months ago. So you want to go back to those early years with music, photographs, things like that. But we want to go into the five senses of soothing and calming a loved one in that final stage.
Sherry, you mentioned at the beginning that there were some neuro design elements to the home that can be done that are a little bit different than the typical aging process. And I know you've mentioned some like light therapy and such, but could you dig in a little bit deeper to what some of those nuanced differences are and how the home prep or the physical space preparations might be able to be started maybe in that first phase when there's still is more communication and ability to plan ahead?
Absolutely. In fact, this is kind of a really exciting area. I'm a huge passionate advocate of all of what's going on in this neurodesign trend. And what's interesting about this neurodesign trend is that it really isn't just for people with dementia or Alzheimer's, it's for all of us. So what we're seeing is that we need our homes and our environments to be healing spaces for us, sanctuary spaces. So what are the design elements that we know tap into the brain and how it functions and brain health that can help with that from a design perspective? So it really is a broad kind of trend. But when it comes to dementia-friendly design, I'll give you a few ideas. First of all, we mentioned the balance issues. So one of the things you want to make sure is that there's a lot of curves and soft things in the home. You don't want any sharp edges where they can, you know, bruise themselves or break skin. You want to make sure maybe you can do it in a very design friendly, beautiful way, but maybe a little handrail in the hallways so that they have something to rest on if their balance is off. Other things like color and contrast. You definitely, if you've got an all white, beautiful kitchen or bathroom, which a lot of us have loved, you know, when we watch all the HGTV shows and everything, those aren't going to work as we get older, and particularly with a dementia brain. You've got to have contrast. So your counters have to be a different shade or color or texture from, you know, maybe the cabinets and other things. One thing I think is really interesting is that the color black, particularly in a rug, can actually, to a dementia brain, that is a big black hole. So if you have a very dark navy brown or black rug, the person with dementia will not walk over that. Now, sometimes those are used in assisted living for safety measures to keep them inside a room or an area, but you want to be aware of that. Stairs, of course, are going to become a fall hazard. And then as they get into the later stages of the disease, again, going back to color, things like white dishes won't work. So you want to use what we found in research is that red dishware is going to trigger their brain to eat everything that's on the plate or drink everything, because they may have also some visual issues and things going on with the brain. So all of these little kind of design elements, and there's a huge long list. I only touched upon some of them, but they become really helpful if you truly are trying to keep your loved one safe, either independently or just, you know, keep them safe at home.
Sherry, I want to transition a little bit from the physical design elements to really the emotional design. I think any of us who've cared for a loved one or interacted with someone with dementia or Alzheimer's, you have this delicate balance between helping them manage their own safety, yet valuing their own independence. And I think for all of us, we all seek to maintain independence as long as we possibly can. How, though, has the stigma around cognitive health impacted the kind of conversations that families have? How important are those conversations, and how do we begin them, or what should we talk to our loved one about, or maybe offer them a chance to share how they feel about whatever it is that they're concerned about? So Talk to us a little bit about the emotional side of things and how we manage it over time.
Yeah, I think, again, going back to just understanding what might be going on with your loved one, knowing what the red flags are, knowing what some of those warning signs are that are early in the disease, maybe even way before a diagnosis. A lot of people say, oh my gosh, I forgot my grandkids' name. You know, I've got 12 grandkids. I can't remember all of their names. Or maybe, you misplaced your keys. Well, I misplaced my keys a couple of weeks ago. And gratefully, I don't have dementia or Alzheimer's, because those are just things that can be because of stress or we're distracted or whatever. And our brains are, not always connecting and filling in that memory. Where it's different for someone with Alzheimer's is that they will put their keys in a very odd place. You've probably seen the commercials where the keys are in the freezer. And I think what's really important for families to know and understand is that what is really happening in the brain, this is not something like a mental illness. This is actually the brain dysfunctioning. And so we talk about neurons and neurotransmitters, and those are the messages in the brain. And what's happening is there's two hallmarks to Alzheimer's. One is called beta amyloid, it's plaque. The other one is called tau, tangles, and that is where things that get tangled up. And so the messages aren't getting through. The other thing that's happening is that the neuronal cells in the brain are actually atrophying, they're shrinking, and they're dying. It's kind of like a computer where you've got your RAM or your memory and your storage, right, for all your files, and then you've got your processing speed. How fast can you find those files? Well, in normal aging, if you can think about all the memories and knowledge that we've accumulated, it's a little slower sometimes to find the files that we need. If you have Alzheimer's in your brain, the file is deleted. It isn't even there. And so when someone says, hi, honey, what time is it? And you answer, and 2 minutes later, they ask you the same question again. It's because the file is no longer in their brain. It just disappears. They aren't able to keep it. So if we can think about that from a compassionate, empathetic way, of this is what's going on with our loved one's brain, I think the biggest thing for everyone out there to know is that despite what stage you're at in the disease, even the very latest stages where you're unable to truly communicate, you can still find joy. And I do a lot of workshops and webinars with family caregivers of those with dementia, talking about how do you find that joy. And just for your listeners, you may remember there was a TV commercial around the holidays a couple of years ago. It was by Chevy truck. And I, by the way, I don't have a connection to them at all, but I just thought they did a really great job because they did a commercial with a grandma who had Alzheimer's, and the granddaughter recognized the need because grandma was not interacting with anyone and didn't look happy. So she got her into the truck and they took a joyride around the neighborhood where she had lived for all these years. And all of a sudden she lit up because it tapped into those very older memories and the music of that era that really brought the grandmother alive. And I think those are the things we need to understand as family caregivers, what can still, spark that joy for our loved ones and for ourselves.
Sherry, how can a financial professional open the conversation with a client about this and just really to, again, help not only understand what wishes are, but creating a path and a plan for the years ahead potentially?
Yeah, I think the financial and cost of care aspect of dementia and Alzheimer's, and by the way, I use those a little bit interchangeably, just really quickly for the audience. Dementia is like a category of diseases, just like cancer is a category. Alzheimer's is a very specific dementia, in fact, represents about 70% of all dementia cases. So it would be similar to like a breast cancer or a prostate cancer. It's a type of dementia. But when we talk about the cost of care, because of the upskilling that is needed by the healthcare professionals who are caring for someone, whether it's in a memory care community, whether it's bringing in the healthcare professionals, home care into the home, it is going to be more costly. And this is where I think, again, financial professionals can help families understand there is the risk of this in your family. Let's take a look at this. Or maybe somebody has just gotten diagnosed early. Okay, let's start to plot a pathway for how we're going to cover these types of costs and what we can tap into, whether it's veterans benefits or, other things that might be able to help with some of those costs. But I think it's, going into it unknown, and then all of a sudden you're in the middle of the crisis, and maybe your loved one is diagnosed later stage disease, and now you're going to embrace all of these. As I mentioned, if you're bringing in 24/7 home care into the home to take care of all those three 8-hour shifts, it's going to cost you about $300,000 a year. That is a shock to a lot of families. They don't anticipate that. And even when I look at some of the charts, they'll talk about home care being about $70,000 a year. Yes, that's for 6.5 hours worth of care coming into the home. The rest is going to fall on you as a family member if you don't have that help. So I think financial planners can help facilitate the conversations, get people thinking about this, and also just not wanting to wait for the crisis. You know, we don't know when, where, how, who, but we can at least start talking about the costs of care and what we might be responsible for.
Well, Cher, your insight today has been incredible. It's certainly helpful to me, I'm sure, as to the listeners as well. But before we let you go, Julie and I have a favorite part of the podcast that we call the lightning round. And aside from all the wonderful stuff that you shared with us about caring for our loved ones, we like to share with our audience a little bit about Sherry by asking these top of mind questions. We just want your first reaction answer just to get us to allow us to know you a little bit better. So if that's okay with you, Julie and I'll start firing away.
Okay.
Julie, have at it.
What's your go-to karaoke song?
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, for the fans of The Sopranos, it's the same as what they ended on, Don't Stop Believing by Journey.
Oh, that's a great one. I love it. You know,
how about, what's your favorite app on your phone?
Oh, gosh. Okay, that's a really, that's a tough one because I have so many that I use. But I guess, you know, honestly, the one that I think has taught me the most is I have my fitness tracker, which tracks you put in your meals. But what I love about it is it's taught me so much about nutrition because I get to see the breakdown of all the nutrients because I'm trying to do better with my micronutrients, which I know are better for brain health. So it's a great tool to use to kind of educate yourself about the types of things you should be eating and where you think you're doing well. And then all of a sudden you get the record, you know, you get the tracking at the end of the day. You're like, oh, okay, didn't have enough protein or didn't have enough vitamin D.
That's great. What's your superpower in one word?
Oh my gosh, that's a tough one. Okay, you guys really, you rocked me with that one.
You can use multiple. We'll allow
it. I don't know if it's a superpower, but I think something that has been just part of, you know, since I was born, my mom would probably tell you, I'm just a very curious person. I love to learn new things, talk to new people. So that curiosity, I think, has really propelled me through life.
What's the first concert you ever went to?
Oh, that's okay. Well, going back to your first question, I think it was a Journey concert. You can tell I was a Journey fan.
What's your favorite quote or mantra?
Oh, gosh. Well, I love this one, which is the art of living is the art of letting go gracefully, which I just feel speaks to taking the stress in your life and modulating it and being able to be empathetic to others. Even, you know, if you feel like there's been confrontation or whatever, it's that gracefulness, that kind of breathing, that letting that out. So I love that. But I also love actions speak louder than words because I think sometimes we talk a lot, but then what do we really do to put that into action is important.
I think that is such a great way to wrap up. And Sherry, we can't thank you enough for joining us here today on the Human Centric Investing Podcast. And for our listeners, if you would like to find out more about Sherry, please feel free to visit her website at caregivingclub.com as well as her YouTube channel. So thank you again for all of your insight. We cannot tell you how much we appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Thanks for listening to the Hartford Funds Human Centric Investing Podcast. If you'd like to tune in for more episodes, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And follow us on LinkedIn, Twitter, or YouTube.
And if you'd like to be a guest and share your best ideas for transforming client relationships, email us at guestbooking@hartfordfunds.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Talk to you soon. The views and opinions expressed herein are those of the guest, who is not affiliated with Hartford Funds.